Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
Having and to wrestle with the ear sets here.
The sound that we get is unpleasant, but that's all right. Hopefully you're getting good sound, and this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And the Personal Wealth Coach is not only a noisy radio program, at least noisy to us. It's also the name of a registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas. And the two guys that run that firm also are the two guys that work on this radio program. And we're regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission, United States Securities and Exchange Commission. That's our regulator of, oh, that was interesting.
Sorry about that.
Of choice or non-choice, as the case may be. And all the stuff that we say on here is, we get it from sources we believe to be correct and accurate, and we make every reasonable effort to make sure that's correct. But we don't warranty or guarantee it, and none of the information we provide on this radio program should be considered to be investment advice, even though our firm is, in fact, a registered investment advisory firm. Why should it? That's better, actually. It should not be considered to be investment advice, because investment advice is given to individuals based on their individual situation. This is educational information, and it may or may not apply to you.
Yeah.
Close cover before striking. Well, people don't know what that means anymore, I don't think. Because they have to have a cover to close.
Or I mean, slide a box.
When's the last time you saw somebody use a little book of matches to light something?
Well, I've seen it happen, but it usually doesn't say close cover before striking anymore.
It doesn't?
No. I guess it's one of those things that nobody's done a lawsuit on in the last couple of decades, so they can take the warning label off. Just like coffee is hot.
I think
if there's not enough
there
lawsuits
seems to be some
in
other
the next decade or so, they'll take that label off until the next lawsuit.
Do not use this product if this seal with this thing written on it isn't here.
Right.
As if it wasn't here, you'd see the sign.
Right.
Oh, okay. That'll
well,
do.
It's right up there. The catch-22s are great. It's like, please sign electronically this consent to receive electronic documents.
Huh? We got a caller on 773-1400, which, by the way, 254-773-1400 is the number to call in here. I got a better one for you.
All right.
It's when I go up there and they say at the hospital, here, sign on this pad. I said, what am I signing? You're signing the release and consent form. What release and consent form? Well, I'll give it to you after you sign.
What?
I'm serious.
Yeah, that's the way it works.
Last time I went to the to Scott and White, they presented me with this little pad and they said, sign here.
Yeah, I've had the same thing.
And I said, what am I signing? Well, you're signing this pad.
Well, it just goes with the rest of the technological world that we live in. When you get an update on your phone, it says, I agree to these changes. You're just trying to make a phone call. You're not trying to read 17 pages of legal documentation in fine print to say, yes, I agree. Anyway, we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. Excuse me. Earlier this week, they repealed a couple of sections of Dodd-Frank, and I'm just worried or wondering if the banking system is a lot riskier now. Can you kind of go through that and explain that, please? Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call.
The parts of Dodd-Frank mainly they repealed were what I refer to as peripheral junk.
Yeah.
And basically it said, hey, some gigantic Uber banks with trading desks who originated securities and did weird stuff blew the system up. So let's make all banks, including the local community banks, follow some really, really stiff regulatory standards and have bigger reserves than they used to. And the problem, of course, is the small community banks are not in the habit of underwriting mortgage related bonds or any of that other risky stuff. They just make loans to people and take deposits, but they still had to follow the same procedures.
Right. Here's the thing. Too big to fail was those were the words that were being tossed around during the Dodd-Frank Act. They said, we've got too many banks that are too big to fail. We've got to put them under enhanced regulation because if they fail, they can bring down the whole system. They're too big. But then they set the size of the bank that falls under that at $50 billion in deposits. That's not $50 billion in assets. That's $50 billion in liabilities. So if you've got a deposit at a bank, if you say, I'm going to take my paycheck, have it directly deposited in the bank, that's an asset to you, but it's a liability to the bank. It's a liability that's the only way they make money. You've loaned them money so that they can make loans. But if you show up at any point, you can say, give me my money, and they're required to give you your money. That's a callable at no notice bond, if you will. That's part of the reason why interest rates are so low when you go to the bank. All right, so Dodd-Frank said, we've got to be careful because these big banks failed and started to take down the entire system. I think the humor is that both Dodd and Frank were in opposite frame of mode in 2006 when they were saying, hey, Barney Frank's famous quote, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, when talking about the banking system in 2006. So having his name on Dodd-Frank is a little bit of humor, a dark humor maybe. But anyway, they set the limit. They, as a reactionary movement to the Great Recession and to the fact that they were pretty culpable themselves, went extremely in the opposite direction from what they had been before the failures. They said, we've got to regulate anybody that's even close to being big. $50 billion is a lot of money until you compare it to the size of the banking industry. And the banking industry, that's a small amount of money. So those are referred to generally as community banks. Now, that's a big community. That'd be a community bank of Dallas or the whole Dallas community. So $50 billion, it's a big community, but it's still considered a community bank. This isn't Wells Fargo. This isn't one of the really big banks. This is still a relatively small bank. Well, it's under enhanced scrutiny, enhanced regulation from the Federal Reserve, according to Dodd-Frank, which was putting a lot of paperwork requirements on these relatively large banks, but not in the big leagues banks. So what that does is the big league bank can afford to pay the price to do all the accounting requirements, to work with the Federal Reserve, to have a whole staff doing just that. And a community bank doesn't. So it was raising the cost of doing business with these smaller banks and make it easier for the bigger banks to do business. And if you look at a graph of the big bank's growth versus the little bank's growth, you'll see what is completely predictable knowing that is that the big banks have gotten a lot bigger while the community banks have been struggling at that same level. There have been a lot of mergers to bring them up to a bigger area, which is the opposite of what Dodd-Frank was trying to do. They were trying to say, let's get rid of the big banks and encourage more small banks. Instead, they made the big banks bigger and the little banks go away. So this is not a gutting of Dodd-Frank. This is not a destruction of Dodd-Frank. This was a statement saying,
a trimming, I would say.
Yeah, we need to look at the reality of the world. This is not a too-big-to-fail bank. It's gone up to now $250 billion instead of $50 billion. So,
yeah, it really is sort of a common-sense thing that the Dodd-Frank was a bit of an overreaction to the not at the large bank area, but it was an overreaction at the smaller bank area, and it pushed a little too far out.
Yeah, and we were the first to say, while it was going on, that they went overboard. They made it much too restrictive to become a publicly traded company. They made it too restrictive to do business as a bank. It was better than what was there before, but they overdid it.
Which is why it went through on a bipartisan basis. Even Barney Franks has said, it should be trimmed.
Whoops, we went a little too far there.
And so, Barney Frank, I think.
Yeah, there's only one of him.
Well, let's talk about the stock market for a moment. If you look at the large index or indices or whatever, the S&P 500 is up for the week a whopping 0.31%, which doesn't sound like much of anything at all. It isn't. Year to date, The S&P 500 is up 1.78%. Now, therein is a bit of a difficulty. For 12 months, it's up 12.65, which sounds really good, but it's not continuing that run up. If we continue flat for a few more months, you won't see those double-digit one-year numbers anymore. So this one of the questions, obviously, to go into this for just a moment, is why is the stock market in essence flat this year when we had literally record earnings across the board in the first quarter? We saw earnings jump something like 30% from the previous year. The revenues are up about 9% in U.S. companies, but profits are up about 30%. And, of course, main reason profits are up, it's a one-shot deal.
Taxes.
And the fact their taxes got cut. And so that's what happened. Now, but still, given the fact that the earnings are coming in so good, would be reasonable to expect in a steady state economic environment that you would see the stock market breaking records at this point rather than sitting considerably lower than it was at the end of January. We're down substantially from the end of January. We're okay from the beginning of the year because during the month of January, the stock market went up. You can see the collapse of the stock market back down to basically where it was at the beginning of the year by noting what you can actually follow the tweet track. When the president announced that he was putting a big tariff on steel and aluminum, the stock market went bloop.
Yeah, that's another term. It's synonymous with crash.
Down. Well, not really crash. It just went down. It went bloop. Bloop isn't bloop. Crash. Yeah, bloop is not as bad as a crash. Anyway.
Well, you've got boom and crash and bloop now. Okay, it went bloop.
And this last week, we saw this happen again. The stock market started up based on the fact that China agreed to buy more stuff, well, specifically agricultural commodities from the United States.
And specifically mentioned that its internal tariff, it has a tariff on our automobiles.
Right.
25%.
Right.
They lowered it to 6%.
Well, it's interesting because President Trump announced that we were putting a tariff on, and just a few minutes later, China announced it was taking the tariff off. Chinese stocks went up, U.S. stocks went down. And that tells you
We're switching places here.
That tells you a world about what's going on. The bottom line to it is, one of the important things to understand, let's just look at something we all can relate to, and that is American automobile manufacturing. Literally, there is one automobile manufacturer in the United States that makes its cars 100% in the United States, and that's Tesla. And most of you do not have a Tesla. Even if you put your deposit down, you still probably don't have a Tesla because Tesla can't get their production lines up to speed because of, among other things, they can't find enough people to work. And U.S. automobile manufacturers import part or all of literally all of the automobiles they make in the United States. We say they're made in the United States. The parts may come from Mexico or Canada. That's part of NAFTA. Basically, U.S. companies have diversified across Mexico, the United States, and Canada, if not elsewhere. Toyota actually makes more of its Toyotas in the United States than General Motors does. And as a result, you get this peculiarity. If the automobile tariffs of 25% go into effect, as the president has suggested, and he's ordered an investigation to see if it affects national defense if we import automobiles, the people he's got doing the investigation probably know the answer they're going to come up with before they start the investigation.
Yeah, which means it's not a real investigation.
But the point is that because if you look at the bill, the 1962 bill, it basically says almost anything can constitute
strategic
or national defense. In other words, the fact that about half of the parts and automobiles combined, the value of a vehicle sold in the United States are made outside the United States, probably will be considered an economic threat. The problem with this is it will raise the cost of American automobiles made by American companies, mostly in the United States, very substantially because they get, in many cases, they make the parts in the United States. They ship the parts to right across the border to Mexico, where there actually are people who are able to work, who can work. And then they ship them back in the United States. And that's been without tariff. It's been considered to be domestic production until now. And so the market went back down again, and that's why we only wound up with a 0.31% gain this week.
All right. So I'm going to address kind of the underlying issue. Should jobs be protected? It's a big question. It's a question that has stumped a lot of presidents, a lot of governmental officials, and a lot of capitalists. So if you just think from a job perspective, if you have a job and it's disappearing, you want somebody to help you because you don't want to lose your job. So that's one perspective. Next perspective, we're going to talk about an industry that no longer exists. We could use rubber, but I instead am going to talk about Curtis Mathis televisions. You remember Curtis Mathis televisions? I remember Curtis Mathis televisions. There are some people listening to this program who do not remember Curtis Mathis televisions. Curtis Mathis was the top-of-the-line television manufacturer in the world. They made fine woodworking and the newest in tube technology combine into this piece of art that would be in people's living rooms. They made the largest televisions, and by large, I mean typically they were around 250 pounds. It took
21 inches from
right
diagonally.
It took a team of people to get it into your house, and if you ever wanted to move, you might have thought about leaving the television with the house. They were beautiful. The woodworking on it really was amazing. The technology in the tube was top of the line. You had good antenna technology. Even when cables were first showing up in people's houses where they were saying, hey, the cable connection is here, Curtis Mathis was one of the first adopters. People don't want to spend the equivalent of $5,000 on a 21-inch television anymore.
Black and white television.
Right.
Of course, later they came out with color.
If you adjust for inflation, you're talking about a $5,000 to $10,000 purchase for a television. When today you show up and you can get a 27-inch television for $200 that you can carry with one hand. So do we need to preserve Curtis Mathis jobs? This is where economics comes in and where politics needs to take a step back for a moment. We may want to consider allowing politics to ease the transition from a job at Curtis Mathis to something else. But to preserve Curtis Mathis is what we laughed at the Japanese for doing with their zombie companies. They don't let their companies fail. The ones that do not work are not allowed to fail. The government props them up, whether it's a bank or another industry, and it's been one of the biggest reasons that Japan has had so much trouble getting out of a recession for the last several decades. So come forward to today, whether it's coal or automobiles or doesn't matter the job, approach it from how do we need to ease the transition rather than saving an industry that has become obsolete? Rubber is a great example. People think, well, what do you mean rubber is a good example? I have rubber on my tires. Yes, you use a petroleum product that is made to imitate rubber. Rubber is a tree. It is a bark from a tree.
Right, it's sap.
Well, sap and bark, yes. And you can mix the bark with the sap to get a tougher rubber. So you've got this sap coming from a tree. It was a big industry at the beginning of the automotive explosion where, and that doesn't mean like an actual explosion. This is hyperbole.
It's a car bomb.
Yes, there's not a car bomb going off here. When people started buying automobiles en masse, they were using tree sap and bark for their tires.
And they made them out of balloons.
Yes.
Because they're called balloon tires.
Yeah. So do we need to preserve all the jobs that are lost in growing rubber trees? No. What we do need to do is retrain people that were growing rubber trees. If they're part of our economy, we don't want them just to be sitting there doing nothing. And we need to train them to do something else. The issue with saving the coal industry is that we now have a much cheaper, cleaner type of energy, natural gas, and it's very abundant. Coal has always been abundant, and that has been its lead for everything. It is not clean. The black fogs of London were from coal burning. Coal burning is not clean. It costs a lot of money to clean up the burning coal, which is why natural gas is cheaper, because it doesn't cost a lot of money to clean what you're burning there. If you work in the coal industry, it doesn't feel good to have a new technology come in and replace your existing technology.
3 minutes to your next Fox News 3030.
I got to get this 3 minute stations thing out of my... There we go. All right. I should have done that at the beginning. Sorry about that. All right. So...
How are we set for commercials?
We've got some. So there are several commercials to play this hour.
Okay.
So this idea of what job do you preserve? How do you preserve jobs? There are absolutely strategic reasons why you would want to limit trade in a given area.
Tanks,
airplanes, food, even steel, even aluminum, but not as a incentive for trade wars. This is the thing. If it's a real strategic issue, what needs to happen is that the money from the tariff... And there's money going to the government for these tariffs. Needs to go immediately into a program to give grants on feasibility of iron mines in the United States. To give grants or special small business loans to companies that want to start up steel mills. That's not what we're doing.
Let's talk about steel for just a second. I think it's important to understand something. If indeed, and it wasn't, but if indeed it was a strategic issue where we have a limited number of steel mills and aluminum mills in the United States, and they're gradually shutting down, so we need to keep steel mills and aluminum mills in the United States for national security purposes.
Right.
Under those circumstances, If you stopped right there, there is an argument to be made that it's in the best interest of national security to keep our ability to produce steel domestically
absolutely
online.
However, I agree with that. That's a good argument.
However, there is a reversal to this. Even the steel mills that are opening up and the ones that are already open are incapable of processing steel ore that originates in the United States or
Correct.
U.S. territories. Therefore,
Correct.
We are still strategically dependent upon, guess what, Africa
yeah.
to get high-quality iron ore. Now, if we really wanted to focus on, okay, we need to have a strategic ability for national defense to manufacture our own steel, it would be very expensive from a federal government point of view because what we would have to do is pay to have steel mills and an entire supply chain that could dig out steel, iron ore from the United States,
yeah.
which is low grade compared with the iron ore from Africa.
But while it would cost money, it isn't that different from the Farm Bill. That's a
right.
bipartisan thing usually. Every year.
Which didn't pass.
Didn't pass because of another bill, immigration issues. It was a negotiating chip, and it shouldn't have been. But this idea that why is it that we pay farmers not to grow and we pay other farmers to grow. We've got corn abundance. We mm-hmm. are subsidizing that tremendously with tax credits as well
as
actual.
We subsidize sugar.
Why do we do that? Well, we do that because there's a strategic reason to do it.
Sure.
We want to be in a place where if we go to war, we are not dependent on long convoys reaching our continent from overseas
right.
to continue to eat,
and
because those are easily targeted.
If we wanted to do that with steel, it would be really simple. Of course, it would cost several hundred billion dollars a year.
We'd have to do the same thing that we do with the Farm Bill. Basically it.
We would have to subsidize. Well, what we'd have to do is we'd have to say, hey, look, steel mill operators, we will pay you extra. The government will basically say, you pay no taxes and we'll give you money back. If you will regear your plant to operate off of low-quality iron ore
right.
that we can dig out of the ground in the United States. Then we'd have to go to the iron ore manufacturing, to the iron ore mines that are closed, and open them up and find people to work there and convince them that the government would be consistent in supplying a demand for low-grade iron ore.
There is high-grade iron ore in the United States. There's a lot of it in the United States.
Where?
It's hard to get to, which is one of the issues. You got to dig under a lot of granite to get to it. That's hard stuff to dig through.
Mm-hmm.
There's also places where it's easier to get to, but the effect of mining it would destroy a lot of the laws that we already have in place about strip mining. So we have to ask some hard questions. This isn't an easy answer situation. This strategic law is being used to change trade imbalances. If it were being used to prepare strategically for something, to prevent a strategic weakness from continuing in the United States, it would go about in a very different way. There is no proactive approach to creating a steel industry or improving the steel industry of the United States. There was a governmental approach to put a 25% tariff on all steel coming into the United States. There are lots of exceptions that have popped up, but the reality is that Wall Street Journal did an article on it this week. Steel prices are up 50% from what they were. So they were at $600 a ton. They're now at $900 a ton. In Europe and in Japan, they're still at $600 a ton, which means if we produce a car using steel made in the United States, it's more expensive than a car that's made overseas. Even if we put a tariff on the cars, we're still talking about an expense that's really hard to make up. All we're going to do is handicap ourselves across every industry if we start with steel, but now our automobiles aren't competitive because the steel tariff is making it more expensive. So let's put a tariff on automobiles. What we wind up doing is sanctioning ourselves, saying that our trade with the rest of the world has been sanctioned. In effect, what we've done to Iran and North Korea, we're volunteering for by increasing tariffs across the board. It's not a strategically good idea. Strategically good ideas have to do with reinforcing an industry. If you just look at what's worked and what hasn't worked in the past, it's very clear tariffs have not worked. I'm not a big fan of the big subsidies that are going into the farm bill, but it's very clear that we have kept a strategic weakness from occurring. We have the ability to feed ourselves. If we have a national priority of having the ability to have steel from ourselves, then the approach would be very similar, I would think. That's my my inference to trade wars.
The bottom line, and Jake has talked about this before, is that tariffs are taxes. The market jumped upward at the first part of the year because of, and at
tax
the last
cuts.
Part of last year, because of tax cuts.
Yeah.
But then I don't think there was any intent by the Trump administration. What they did is they basically and it's interesting, a 21% tax cut,
mm-hmm.
or cut to 21 from 39 to 21%, okay?
Yeah.
And then imposing 36. And then imposing a 25% tariff on the importation of the main raw materials that are used in manufacturing. Now, I mentioned this in an earlier radio program. I mentioned it in the newsletter too. The interesting thing, of course, was that it put American automobile manufacturers at somewhat of a disadvantage because they have to make they're going to be either shift jobs to Canada and Mexico where they're not paying the 25% import duty,
right?
Or the price of cars in the United States will need to go up substantially to cover the fact that steel has now jumped 40-50% in price from
50,
where it was before.
Yeah.
Now, so obviously somebody pointed that out. That's the only thing I can say. Somebody pointed that out to the president that now we can, but the steel in cars that's being imported is not being hit with a 25%.
The answer to that is put a tariff on that too.
So you put a tariff on the cars.
Eventually, we'll have a tariff on everything because if you distort the marketplace, If you say this area is more expensive, we've been talking about this for decades. We've become more and more of a global trade environment. We depend on the rest of the world for a lot of the raw materials, as they depend on us for a lot of their raw materials. We can stop that, but it's going to be painful. It's going to be painful for us and for them. It will slow down technology's growth. That's the end result of limiting trade. If you expand trade within reason, you don't want to be trading with murderers and people that are obviously breaking the law. But if you expand trade in a reasonable way, you expand technology, you expand innovation, and you expand everybody's standard of living. If you limit trade, you lower your standard of living. You lower even the existing technology, the stuff that's already there, begins to go away. And that's just what happens historically. This isn't me making a prediction about this. It's just I don't know why it wouldn't go that path. That's the way tariffs lead every time they've ever been used. It's really hard to look back and find anything positive about tariffs in the long term. Now, in short term, what's happened right now is that steel companies in the United States are making record profits. It's not showing up yet, but it will, because the price per ton of steel is way up. Even if they just keep doing exactly what they were doing before, they're going to make a lot of money. But who's paying for it? We are. We've just raised the price of steel in the United States by 50%. So where we are.
If we if indeed the tariff 25% on automobiles goes through, the American Automobile Sales Organizations have noted that their low ball estimate is that 160,000 fewer cars will be sold per year, which means they'll start laying people off.
What this amounts to long term is the government setting
industrial policy,
the industrial policy and the economic pricing of the entire economy.
And
that doesn't work unless you want to go to a totalitarian or communist system.
And of course, the argument can be made that China has an overcapacity,
and it
is a result. In order to keep their factories running, they sell steel at a lower price than other people do. That's
certainly true. We call
that
dumping.
It really isn't dumping. Dumping is when you sell it for less than it takes to make it.
Right.
And they're not selling it for less than they get to, but they are able to make steel at a lower price because A, they have these huge facilities that aren't doing anything. B, their labor is cheaper. And C, they import a lot of iron ore anyway.
From Africa.
Yes. Now, the interesting thing about this is the fact that we put a tariff on steel raises the price of steel in the United States, but it doesn't raise the price of steel for the rest of the world.
No, it lowered the price elsewhere. It gets cheaper elsewhere.
And the knock-on effect, and we've talked about this before, but it's really worth understanding. The knock-on effect is that, for instance, Caterpillar is the dominant supplier of heavy construction equipment in the world, including in Africa, where they're digging the iron ore out of the ground for China. China buys Caterpillar equipment to dig its iron out of the ground in Africa. Now,
there seems something wrong with that.
Well,
you're buying a Caterpillar that's got to use more expensive versions of what it's digging.
The issue is that Caterpillar has announced, when they announced record earnings this quarter, said this is as good as it's going to get because the tariffs have made the cost of building new equipment high enough that we're going to have to raise what we charge when people buy it, which means that our Japanese, and that's the big competitors they have, are from Japan. The Japanese manufacturers of heavy equipment for mining and digging holes in the ground can build their equipment cheaper than Caterpillar can now. As a result, Caterpillar expects to see their sales decline and their employment decline, unless, of course, they start shutting down plants in the United States and moving them to Canada and Mexico. It is a very, very complex operation, and the problem is in an integrated world economy, and we have one whether we like it or not, it's there learning to live with it is a good idea, but we don't have national economies anymore. We have global economies. The United States can't do what it did following World War II, which is following World War II, we were the only functional major economy in the world that hadn't been bombed nearly out of existence.
Right.
So we had this tremendous power to set the standards for everybody. And
we don't have that power.
We kind of have a deep memory of the 50s and 60s when we had that kind of power. We don't have that power anymore. Europe is
they are
Europe and Japan and China and more other places are places where we buy things from and sell things to.
Yeah. Let me throw this piece in because we got to play some commercials real quick. But this, when we put a tariff for strategic purposes, we want to protect our steel industry in the United States. We put a tariff on steel. It causes the steel prices in the rest of the world to go down, which causes their strategic balance to look better. It causes our steel prices to go up, which means that in a war-type footing, it would be more expensive to use steel. It's the opposite of what we were intending to do with it, at least on the surface. That's the stated purpose for what we're doing. It isn't the actual purpose. You know, the tweets immediately said, everybody really knows this isn't about strategy. This isn't about preserving a...
It's about jobs.
It's about jobs. That's what all the tweets are about. Same statement. It's about jobs. It's been said by the president. It's about jobs. He has the right to do this based on a strategic excuse. But the excuse...
Well, the law.
The law is the strategic excuse. But the thing that he's done has exacerbated the strategic weakness, not made it better. And we've got to play commercials.
Right.
Yeah. So we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join us in here, the phone number to call is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Those of you listening on the radio, we do not endorse. Had nothing to do with that advertisement that just went on. And in fact, think that's a pretty dangerous way to going highly leveraged on real estate is a really interesting way to need to see Ed Laughlin.
Yeah. And bankruptcy is a common result.
I do have something to say that I think is important. In Salado today is the Q on Main. And
barbecue.
The Q on Main is a series of a dozen barbecue smokers set up on Main Street in various places in Salado, where if you go buy a wristband, and you can buy one at the community center, which is the big red brick building towards the center of town on Main Street, or right at the intersection of Royal and Main, there's another place there where you can buy a wristband for $10. And then you can go sample barbecue, and you go to if you go to all 12 places where they're doing the barbecue, and they will tell you how to get there and where they are, and you sample the barbecue, and then you vote on each of those, and then you turn in the slip, you're eligible to get a free smoker. They'll be drawing for a free smoker, and I don't know who Kendra Scott is, but they have a Kendra Scott necklace they're also giving away.
I believe Kendra Scott is some kind of a designer. I think she's in the automotive industry.
Well, she's in some kind of, but
no,
there's a
not the automotive.
So you can they're going to have a free drawing. So if you go and force yourself to sample 12 different smokers' wares, which for $10 is a pretty good deal, and then vote on all of them and turn your card back in, you can wind up being a smoker too, or you can wind up if you're not into smoking, you can wear a Kendra Scott necklace maybe.
Right, which seems like it's a pretty sexist thing. What if a woman wants to do the smoking, and what if the man wants the alternative
That's
prize?
That's perfectly,
I mean, the Kendra Scott necklace would look good on me, I think.
It's a second prize, so you could wind up with a man getting this necklace and a woman getting the smoker.
That sounds fantastic.
She could, if she didn't want to smoke, she could always give it to somebody else. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was wanting to know what the difference is between steel and iron and the price difference and how it's used through the industrial products to make different things in the United States.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Okay. What's the difference between steel and iron? Do you want to hit that or you want me to?
Well, iron is soft.
Iron is an element. It's by itself. It is a soft element.
It is almost none of the iron that comes out of the ground is produced for commercial use as iron. It's
cast iron.
Well, but it goes into it.
But that's carbonated.
But when it mixes, when the iron ore is fired up, they mix it with nickel and chromium
to
and
make
a whole
an
bunch
alloy.
Of
alloy. Right.
So they make something called steel, which is a lot harder than iron. Iron, most of the iron that we see in the United States, wrought iron or the rebar, that's iron in the United States. Uh-huh. That is almost all recovered from scrap metal.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty big industry in the United States is the scrap metal, iron scrap metal recovery, which is why they crush cars and they, when buildings are torn down and when ships are torn up and so on, they use them to make scrap metal. And
Now, most of that scrap comes from overseas because we're not scrapping our own stuff anymore.
Well,
we ship most to China to get scrap.
Really? I thought it was the other way around. I thought we were still shipping. We're still exporting. Last I heard, we were still exporting a lot of scrap.
That's what I mean. We ship.
Yeah, we don't bring it in from
China to get scrapped, and then so what we when we buy rebar up till the tariffs. Quite often, we were buying it back from the same places that we were selling the scrap to.
Which doesn't work anymore.
No.
And
it was a bad business decision. It's a bad business model long term, but we were working under some economic constraints that have not disappeared with the tariffs. The economic constraints are we have laws on our
polluting.
Environment
yeah.
and polluting and taking scrap iron and changing it into steel again or into rebar or so on, it causes some pollution. So we've been consciously exporting our pollution with our scrap stuff, whether that's the plastic that is being recycled, which China has put a big stop on, to scrap iron that we're now saying, hey, we don't want to send that elsewhere anymore. It's funny because we do buy scrap iron as well as sending it out. This is one of those things is that a country doesn't act unanimously. There are groups of people selling scrap iron elsewhere, and there are groups of people buying scrap iron from elsewhere. That's the way the market works. And the end result of it has been most of the refining of scrap takes place elsewhere, which gets hit by that tariff again. We've got a lot of scrap. We really have a huge amount of scrap, but we don't have the facilities to convert it anymore.
One of the issues, by the way, that's coming up economically is a lot of the things that are done at the national level that the president does when he sets up a tariff or when we do a tax cut, have a lag between the time they are enacted and put in place until they take effect. And sometimes they have two different effects that they take,
sometimes
a positive one and a negative one.
Sometimes there's a whole cascade of effects.
And, for example, in the short term, throwing a tariff on iron makes wherever it is they have iron manufacturing plants, wherever they make iron, is going to make a lot of voters very happy for a short period of time. The problem, and then the other places where they make things out of steel
are going to be very upset.
Well, they're going to, in the short term, they're not going to feel much of anything because they're still using the piles of steel that they had before, the reserves that they had built up. But about a year to 2 years later, the price of everything that is made out of steel will go up, and they'll be starting to lay off manufacturing workers across the United States.
And about
that time, as they start laying off the manufacturing workers and people buy fewer cars and people, the increased price of things made out of steel in the United States will cause people to buy fewer of them, which means after this surge of opening up iron foundries and hiring people, a couple of years later, they will get laid off. And they'll get laid off because we are not at all competitive automobile manufacturers will say, okay, we can't be competitive putting a lot of steel in cars, so we'll figure out how to put carbon fiber or something else
aluminum,
in the car.
Well, something else.
Aluminum, yeah. Which is not as expensive. We'll figure out how to make cars without so much steel, because the reality is they've got to remain competitive because American car manufacturers want to export cars. They want to send cars elsewhere. They don't want to be in a position where our cars cost 25% more than a car made in Japan.
Why are we hammering on this? Every week for many, many weeks, we've been hammering on this. Why? There is a good parallel here. If there's a medical show, a medical radio program that doesn't talk about the dangers of tobacco or drinking and driving or heart disease as a problem that suddenly a large group of society has decided to do, it's not a very good program.
Well,
this is something that a decision led us to, and another decision or further decisions being made based on this calamity can fix and make better than it was before.
I want to talk about it for a very simple reason. The President of the United States made a decision, a strategic decision, to do something that the Democrats traditionally have done, and that is to make some workers happy in heavy industry.
Right. But
this is the point. Had he not made that series of decisions, there's a very, very high probability that the stock market would be up maybe 5% or something. Probably 10% so far this year.
That we would be seeing closer to 3.4 or 3.5% GDP instead of the expected 3.1.
Well, but the GDP doesn't put money in people's pockets. What happens is if you have a 401k.
It does, just not directly. Go ahead.
And you look at the value of your 401k. Now I'll be really on the low side of your 401k and say you have a $100,000 401k and you got it all in equities, which neither one of which is necessarily true of anybody. It's cost you between $5,000 and $10,000 so far this year in your portfolio because the president has decided to wage trade wars. Now, he called it. He said trade wars are simple. They're easy to win. I enjoy doing them, and I'm going to start one. He said that. He said that. I didn't. So he started.
Well, you said it too. You just.
I'm quoting, but I didn't originate this. I'm quoting him.
Okay.
And the point is, your portfolio has been flat this year, and this is a consensus of literally everybody that I have read, and it's my opinion as well. The reason the stock market is only up less than 2% so far this year in a time of record earnings in U.S. corporations, where the price-to-earnings ratio is actually falling, is simply because people are looking at a couple of very, very serious problems coming down the road. One is trade wars are going to, in a year or two, cost us a lot of productivity, a lot of money in the economy. Therefore, stocks will probably be worth less, they think, than they otherwise would be in a couple of years. The other one is they look at the debt. We'll get into probably next hour. They look into what the Congressional Budget Office solidified and says
There's
about $20 trillion, get this, $20 trillion more deficit going to show up in the next 10 years than the White House said when they were promoting the tax bill.
The tax bill was promoted on the concept of a 4% GDP based on this. Well, that was a bit rosy. We said it at the time. We did expect the GDP to go up, but not to 4%. I was thinking 3.4, 3.5.
Yeah, 3.1 this year, I think.
But now we got tariffs. So we're thinking I'm thinking we're dropping that GDP down, which in effect shoots a hole in the boat for the tax bill.
Well, here's where economics comes in. We do not have the capacity in the United States to grow at 4% a year. And why am I saying that? To grow at 4% a year, we got to move a lot of goods around on the highways because the railroad's already full.
Yeah.
We're out of truck drivers and we're out of trucks. That means we've already hit at least part of the wall on how fast we can grow. When you reach a limitation in an economy, that limitation will bottleneck everything else.
It doesn't matter how much you juice the other parts, that bottleneck is still there.
We could make a lot more stuff, and we could have a lot more people willing to buy it, and we make it on the East Coast, and they want to sell it on the West Coast. The problem is we don't have the trucks to get it from the East to the West Coast.
Right.
The trains are full. And
we used to do a truck count back when we lived in Georgetown and drove to Temple every Saturday. Now we both live in Salado. We haven't done the truck count in a long time, but the last major truck count was 250 trucks. We saw more than that on the way from Salado to Temple. We are at capacity for trucks. You can't put more trucks on these highways.
And we're out of truck drivers, we're out of trucks, but we're also out of highway space to put trucks.
Right.
And so that is we just basically are starting to hit the limits. We can't, and we'll probably get a 3% growth this year. We'll be less the following year and a lot less the year after that. And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we've got a break for Fox News. So if you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail on weekends, real live people during the week at 254-947-1111.
You can reach that toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.